Welcome to the Health Policy Research Consortium podcast, a product of the Health Policy Research Consortium, a CTIS program, your weekly podcast empowering communities to use policy as a vehicle to improve their health and learn how to mobilize your community to create positive change where you live, work, and worship. Wait not a minute more. It's time to get started with the Health Policy Research Consortium podcast.
Welcome to the Health Policy Research Consortium podcast. I'm your host, Patricia Terrell, and joining me is Mr. Daniel Dawes. He's the author of 150 Years of Obamacare. And Mr. Dawes is also the Executive Director of Government Relations, Policy, and External Affairs at the Morehouse School of Medicine. Mr. Dawes, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Patricia. It's great to be on.
Well, it sounds like you're doing a lot of great things, but what we want to talk about today will be federal budget cuts and health equity. So tell us, what is health equity?
So health equity exists when all people, regardless of race, gender, socioeconomic status, or geographic location, have the same access, the opportunities and resources to achieve their highest potential for health. So it's really the attainment of optimal health for all groups.
And why does this matter?
It matters because there are thousands of people who die each year prematurely. In fact, for African Americans alone, we know that number is conservatively between 83,000 and about 100,000 deaths, premature deaths. And it's costing us $300 billion each year. So I argue this is a national security issue because when folks are young or when folks are sick and they're dying younger, they're unable to contribute to their communities, right, mm-hmm. and elevate the status, economic status of their communities. In addition to that, they're then also unable to compete globally, right, with our competitors around the world. And so that, again, is another issue why we should care about this. And then lastly, we should care about it from a policy perspective because we've put up a lot of these arbitrary barriers that have prevented many groups, many vulnerable populations, including racial and ethnic minorities, from achieving their optimal level of health because we have passed or not passed policies that have hindered such. And policy has been the driving force for many of the inequities we observe in the system.
Should only a particular group of Americans be more concerned about this than others?
I think all Americans should be concerned, not just those who are directly and severely impacted by inequities in our health system, for the very same reasons that I articulated earlier.
And how does the federal budget in general affect health equity? What do we need to know?
You know, there are a number of studies over the years that have documented the substantial racial and ethnic disparities in access to service, clinical care, and health outcomes. And as these disparities continue to persist, they have stark financial consequences for not only the affected individuals and the health systems that care for them, but of course in the larger community and our nation. And so the federal budget is the primary funding source behind many of the health systems and resources that our most vulnerable populations rely on. In simple terms, due to the fact that the federal budget determines how much money many of the health equity-related institutions and resources have, less or more funding means less or more access to care, respectively. And that is, quite frankly, why this is important.
Normally, when we start talking about the federal budget, which has been an issue recently, people tend to turn away from that. Why is it that as a mass population, we don't want to deal with the federal budget issues?
I think because it is complicated. So we understand, we've heard President Clinton talk about, you know, health policy being complicated. We heard President Trump admit who knew healthcare can be so complicated. And I think it's for that very reason. It is extremely complicated. It does take time to understand where to even go to access the federal budget and to make sense of how the entire process works. So from the, you know, the time that the president comes out with his budget request at the beginning of each year to the point where the Senate and the House will come up with their own particular budgets, and then you have to go through the appropriation process, which has to meet that budgetary bill. So there's so many pieces that go into crafting this and influencing it, and I think that's one of the main reasons why you'll see folks shying away from it.
And, you know, I'm a process person, and I believe in planning ahead. Why does it, maybe it's me, help me with this, why does it seem like they wait until the last minute to start addressing the budget when we know that it's coming every year, the same time of year? Why does it seem like it's done at the 11th hour and rushed? Is it me?
I ask ask myself that question oftentimes, and I'll tell you, if you look at all of the appropriations bills, and there are about 11 of them, what happens is that health policy, the labor HHS appropriations bill, which contains obviously the financing for U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and for all of these programs that we care deeply about, from programs like HCOP, the Health Careers Opportunities Program, to the Area Health Education Centers Program, which are workforce, healthcare workforce diversity programs, training programs, programs that were created in the early 1970s to expose lower socioeconomic status individuals, communities, and others, to expose them to various health profession careers, right? And so oftentimes what happens is it is so contentious, and that we talked about health policy being very contentious, and it's always the last one, and it tends to hold up this whole federal budget, because they get through all of these other pieces. You're dealing with, you know, funding the VA, the Veterans Administration, funding Department of Education, funding Department of Justice, Homeland Security, et cetera. So apparently there's a lot of consensus on, yeah, we must do that. But when it comes to health care, that's where it gets contentious. And that oftentimes holds up the entire process. And that's why at the 11th hour, you'll see folks saying, all right, fine, let's just go ahead with a continuing resolution.
And was this happening prior to Obamacare?
It was. So during the start of the Obama administration, we know that there was an effort to really put the squeeze, so to speak, on a lot of these health care programs. But that squeeze got even tighter once the ACA passed. So let me give you an idea. When George W. Bush was in office, what we oftentimes saw was, yes, there was some back and forth, but there was at least some consensus. And it usually just resulted in flat funding of the government, right? So nothing major there. We're not going to give you a bump in terms of providing extra financing for your programs. We're just going to keep a level funding from year to year, and you go with that, despite inflation. Under the President Obama's administration, what happened, though, was, yes, there was that contentious effort, but it always got more contentious now once the Affordable Care Act passed. And what opponents of the ACA recognized was that if they were truly going to undermine the Affordable Care Act, the budget was the way to do it. So what they did was every time they had to deal with appropriations, the debt ceiling, sequestration, any of these budgetary items, they often would use it as leverage to get some concession in terms of repealing or modifying a provision in the Affordable Care Act. And that's when you saw things really getting contentious with the budget.
Yeah, and that's what we're experiencing right now.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's get back into health equity in terms of, you know, the current federal budget, which now is delayed. What is the current federal budget approach to health equity?
So I would say that the approach that the current federal budget takes towards health equity,
yes,
can be summed up in one word: aversion. And if I could even go so far, maybe even hostility. So I think from the beginning of this 115th Congress, health equity-related programs and advancements have been hampered both legislatively and administratively, including the federal budget. And that's been problematic. So we know that there was an effort. If you look at the last fiscal years between the Obama administration and now with the Trump administration, it's quite surprising when you look at, let's say, the Minority Centers of Excellence program. We talked about HCOP or scholarships for disadvantaged.
And what is HCOP?
Health Careers Opportunity Program. Yes, it's a workforce diversity program. Then there's the Minority Faculty Loan Repayment Program. And we talked about AHEC, the Area Health Education Centers, the Offices of Minority Health, HHS Office of Minority Health, and the National Institute of Minority Health and Health Disparities, just to name a few, right? What we've seen is that where President Obama has basically, for the most part, always included prioritizing funding for these programs, the Trump administration's first budget for fiscal year 18 has zeroed out all of those, with the exception of the scholarships for disadvantaged students. So that's very telling. And then from there, what we also recognized was that in the House there were certain programs that they also slated for elimination. And then Senate, with the Senate now coming back and agreeing to fund most of them. But there are still a few that the Senate has decided not to agree to fund. And one of them is a huge deal for those of us in public health, for those of us who care deeply about eliminating racial and ethnic health disparities. It's the REACH program, R-E-A-C-H. This REACH program is funded through the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and has existed now. It was created in the Clinton administration. And it was actually devised after numerous studies. In fact, when the initial investment that was made by the federal government, and you might recall that things started really elevating at the federal level during the Reagan administration when Margaret Heckler was secretary, and you had Senator Ted Kennedy and Congressman Lewis Stokes of Ohio, who helped to found the Congressional Black Caucus and the CBC Health Brain Trust. They got together and they said, well, gee, look at all that's been happening. While the overall health of the nation's been improving, the health of racial and ethnic minorities is quite alarming. We've got to do something about it. And so they set about then creating a task force. The task force came out with recommendations. One was to establish an Office of Minority Health at HHS to look at how regulation, various policies at the executive level were impacting racial and ethnic groups. And after that, the George H.W. Bush administration actually said, listen, under Lewis Sullivan, when he was Secretary of Health and Human Services, that we've got to come together now and we've got to codify these recommendations from that task force under the Reagan administration into law. And so they did that, and they made an initial investment in 1990 of $1 million to study racial and ethnic health disparities. And from that $1 million investment has basically blossomed into over 6,000 peer-reviewed journal articles from medicine, nursing, public health, law, business, economics, you name it, looking at these inequities in our system and the cost drivers, right? And so from there, after that, we had the Clinton administration saying, well, if we're truly going to get at these issues, we've got to look at this from a systematic level. We've got to look at the various upstream, midstream, and downstream factors impacting health equity. And that was why they created the REACH program. So it was really building upon past Republican administration efforts and then taking that to a whole new level. And then the Obama administration came in and took that to an even greater level. So it is, quite frankly, frightening to see what is happening in terms of undermining these health equity related programs.
Yeah, it's really disconcerting to see, especially when you think about the vulnerable populations who are impacted by it all. And but let's talk about you for a moment. You wrote this book, 150 Years of Obamacare. I'm really curious about the title. Are you saying that Obamacare will survive 150 years, or what are you saying?
Well, one thing is certain. I think you'd agree with me, Patricia, is that, you know, Obamacare certainly has more lives than a cat.
Yes.
And has come up against now more than 11 brushes with death.
Has it been 11 already?
Actually, more than that. I've lost count. I have to go back and count. With the latest attempts at repealing this very comprehensive and inclusive law. In fact, you know, I argue in 150 Years of Obamacare that this is the most inclusive health law that has ever been produced and passed by the U.S. Congress. And it's something that all of us as health equity champions should be proud of. But to answer your question, in terms of the title, we take a past, present, and future look at Obamacare. And I think when you look at the past 150 years, it shows how far we've certainly come. And what I wanted to do from that point was to help folks understand and realize we actually had a comprehensive health reform law on the books 150 years ago. It was a law that abolitionists had fought very hard to get passed so that newly freed slaves, of course primarily African Americans, and refugees who were poor whites who were displaced by the Civil War would have access to health care. And so what happened was that opponents of that health reform effort won after 7 years in repealing that law. So on the seventh anniversary of that law, it was fully repealed and undermined. And what I was concerned about was, you know, if history is any indication, and we saw the constant hostility towards the Affordable Care Act, I was concerned that if we weren't careful and if we as leaders didn't continue to raise our voices for why this was a good thing and why we needed a law that would advance this robust health equity agenda, that we could be repeating the mistakes from 150 years. And as you saw, there was this concerted effort, very strong effort by opponents in the House and Senate to repeal the ACA on its seventh anniversary. We would have been repeating history. So, yes, we're still in that seven-year phase. This is the longest surviving comprehensive health reform law we've ever had on the books. And this is why it is certainly worth paying attention to with the debates because, again, you know, we not only, if you look at the difference between the effort to repeal this law and the effort to actually pass it, they're striking. The Affordable Care Act brought together stakeholders from every corner of our health system, all stakeholders, brought in racial and ethnic diversity, brought in LGBT, people with disabilities, rural, urban, frontier, you know, you name it, just a host of folks that brought their unique lens to influence or inform the bill that was being drafted at the time in 2009. And so that is such a beautiful thing to me. But then you juxtapose that to what's been happening lately, and again, you see the striking contrast where, again, lacking diversity, process, just it has been, I mean, absolutely failing in every respect when it should be more transparent and inclusive. So that's that past vision. And, of course, I look at other health reform campaigns with mental health. For those of us who care deeply about mental health reform, the efforts there, the trials and tribulations that mental health reformers struggled with. And then you look at the universal health reformers and the struggles there as well. So it's very eye-opening. And then, you know, when we look at future, what do we need to do to ensure that we continue down this path of a more accessible, equitable, and person-centered health system? Here's what we're going to need to do in order for Obamacare to continue and to build and repair upon those achievements.
Another example of history repeating itself. So tell us where we can get your dynamic book.
So they can get the book from Amazon.com or any major bookstore at Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, or they can get it directly from Johns Hopkins University Press with the publisher.
And so with your work that you're doing over at Morehouse School of Medicine, how does this tie into health equity and federal budget cuts when it comes to the allocation of federal resources? Is that part of your work there at Morehouse?
Absolutely. So policy and finance, as you know, are two sides of the same coin, right?
That's right.
Without appropriated funding for these critical federal health equity programs, as we mentioned, HCOP, AHEC, the National Institute of Minority Health and Health Disparities, and the Office of Minority Health, we would not have achieved some of the successes we have in the last 35 years. And so, you know, at Morehouse School of Medicine and other entities at our Health Equity Leadership and Exchange Network, what we have been doing is to make sure that we continue to inform groups that also align with us on these issues, that believe that health equity is a good thing, believe that we should be continuing down that path, and making sure that they are kept informed about the latest developments in terms of policy. So not only in terms of authorizations, but appropriation, because it is critical. If we lose funding for even one of these programs, we know that it is extremely difficult to try to get that program either authorized and appropriated, or to even get appropriations the next time around if it is still on the books. So we are mindful of that, and we continue to watch it very carefully and alert our stakeholders and other champions to getting gear to speak up and to make sure that you're pushing back on any attempts to either defund or to terminate funding.
Well, before we close, why don't you let us know what we can do on the individual level to influence policy, the federal budget process, health disparities, and improving health equity? This seems so large that it doesn't seem like one individual can matter. Tell us how we can matter on the individual level and community level.
So I'm going to actually bring up a quote that I heard from Marion Wright Edelman back in 2008. Where she reminded us that a new president and Congress is only going to be as good as the citizens outside demanding it. And I think for us, we are in a very interesting time. We are working with policymakers that are either very new and have no idea what this health equity movement is all about. Many of them believe that health equity is code for African Americans. And many of them, in addition, quite frankly, are just hostile towards the issue. And I think with this type of administration, we have to be very careful that we continue to reinvent ourselves or reinvent the message, re-message. We have to make that business case. You're dealing with an administration of folks who are business-minded. So I would actually urge our folks to continue to make that business case, make an economic argument for why health equity is critical in bending the cost curve and saving lives. I would actually urge folks to show the return on investment that a lot of these federal programs have been having on our communities, the impact both qualitatively and quantitatively, because they are gung-ho about reorganizing various programs, merging them, or terminating. And case in point, you have the reorganization of the Office of Minority Health. We had to push back on that to make the case for why OMH is still relevant. Then there were attempts to cut the prevention fund and vital research programs. Again, we had to push back on that. And then now we're dealing with the negation of racial and ethnic minority health from the new U.S. Department of Health and Human Services strategic plan. So I just urge folks to continue to be aware, to be woke, as folks have called it, and make sure that they are speaking up. Don't leave that to anyone else. And if you don't know, feel free to reach out to us. We would be more than happy to walk you through how you can access the budget, how you can read through it and make sense of it.
Now, that sounds really interesting. We may have to bring you back on another show to talk about that process. So
sure.
Where could they reach you to learn about that?
Absolutely. So they can either go to our website for the HELEN Network, our Health Equity Leadership and Exchange Network, HELEN, which is www.healthequitynetwork.org, or they can find us at ddaws@msm.edu or call us directly at 404-752-1833.
Great. Great information you gave us today. Still a lot to be done. And just want to thank you, Mr. Dawes, for joining us on the Health Policy Research Consortium podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Health Policy Research Consortium podcast. Remember, you have the power to use policy to improve your picture of health where you live, work, and worship. For more information on the Health Policy Research Consortium podcast, visit our website at www.hprc.info and like us on our social media channels, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr.
The research and information that we report during this show was supported by the National Institute on Minority Health and Health Disparities of the National Institutes of Health under award number 5U54MD008-60802. The content is solely the responsibility of the authors and does not necessarily represent the official views of the National Institutes of Health.